All right. Let's see. So when I left off last time, I was in the middle of talking about measuring a standard ruler at a cosmological distance. And we decided that the angle that the ruler subtends on the sky is given by its coordinate distance, not its physical distance at the time when the photon is emitted. Divided by c delta conformal time. Let me show you one sort of counterintuitive implication. It might be counterintuitive. Let's suppose that I consider a standard ruler of fixed physical size and just slide it further and further back along the light cone. So let me write the formula as delta x physical divided by the scale factor at the time when the photon is emitted. Times delta tau, I'll just get rid of the c. So what happens as the distance to the standard ruler increases, or the look-back conformal time tau increases, is that initially the object will appear to get smaller as it goes further away. I think I first learned this from Grover on Sesame Street. But then after a while, it starts to go back up. As you move the object from the standard ruler further and further away, it looks bigger and bigger in the sky. That's because that's related to the horizon problem, the causal horizon problem, or the fact that the total conformal time in our universe, at least if we don't look all the way back into inflation, is finite. As you bring the ruler closer and closer to the Big Bang, the conformal time in the denominator is just approaching a constant, but the scale factor can get arbitrarily small, which means that delta theta gets arbitrarily large. Of course, so this is a little counterintuitive, but it makes sense when you think about it. If the total conformal time in our past light cone is finite, that means that we can only ever observe a patch of the universe of fixed co-moving size. And so if I go very close to the Big Bang, that fixed co-moving size corresponds to an arbitrarily small physical size. And so an arbitrarily small ruler fills the whole past light cone and appears arbitrarily large in the sky. The minimum here it occurs at about a redshift of 2. So when you look back to a redshift of 2, that's where you're getting sort of the least magnified view of the universe in the sense that you get to see our 4 pi steradians on the sky corresponds to the maximum possible physical volume. So just as a bit of terminology, this denominator, a delta tau, is what's sometimes called the angular diameter distance. That combination. Is what you use to convert between physical distances on the past light cone and angles on the sky. This conversion assumes that, by the way, the formula is more complicated in a curved universe. It's no longer just the conformal time. There's another factor. So in a universe with curvature, there would be a distinction between the angular diameter distance and the conformal time. This picture assumes that we're talking about a ruler which is fixed in physical size, not a ruler that expands with the universe. That would be a ruler which is fixed in coordinate size. If your standard ruler expands with the universe, then there's no factor of A, you'd use this formula. And so if I move the ruler further and further backward in time, something more intuitive happens where this curve would just approach a constant. Now it is the case that we measure standard rulers in cosmology, but the standard rulers are usually something more mathematical, like a differential equation. You have a differential equation describing the evolution of modes as a function of their wavelength. And there might be some particular wavelength where something interesting happens in the differential equation, and you get some sort of feature that you can look for. So those types of standard rulers tend to be coordinate distance standard rulers, their size. If I have a fluctuation in the universe and I let it evolve with time, then its wavelength will stay fixed in in co-moving coordinates, not in physical coordinates. So most of the time when we measure standard rulers in cosmology, we're actually in this situation. Okay. So conformal time is another useful time coordinate. Another useful time coordinate The way you can think about conformal time, by the way, is it's just sort of look back coordinate distance on the past light cone. This conformal time delta t is the same as the coordinate distance back on the light cone. So another useful time coordinate is just simply the scale factor a, or sometimes log a is more convenient. This is useful because it just directly links to the energy density, or equivalently the Hubble parameter. These guys have simple expressions. Let me write them like this. I've used Friedman's equation on the second line. Simple expressions in terms of the scale factor A. So for example, if you want to calculate the age of the universe, A is the variable in which you integrate Friedman's equation. So for example, if you want to calculate the age of the universe for a given expansion history, for a given set of three parameters here, I want to integrate dt. If I change variables, let me write that as d log a over h. H is the conversion between d log a and dt. Or dA over ah. Similarly, if you want to integrate Friedman's equation, you should do it with time coordinate A, not time coordinate T. Okay. So from what I've said so far, you would say that the parameters of the expansion history could be the radiation density today, that physical density, the matter density today, and the cosmological constant lambda. Let me actually do one little thing here, which is split. Pretty soon we're going to want to split the cosmological parameter rho m0 into a cold dark matter piece plus a baryonic matter piece. So let me just do that now and say that the parameters of the expansion history are rho c0, rho b0, rho r0, and lambda. Of course, as far as integrating Friedman's equation is concerned, rho c0 and rho b0 are degenerate. From a physicist's perspective, specifying these four numbers would be the natural way to parameterize the expansion history. In cosmology, there are a few places where you have to get used to some weird units. And so I'm going to explain the weird cosmologist parameterization. So first off, instead of specifying rho I, rho I zero, where I is a species, you specify the fractional abundance of that species today. So omega I is defined to be rho I zero over the sum of all the rho j zeros. This definition implies that the sum of the omegas by definition, is one. In a universe with curvature, the things are defined slightly differently, so that the sum of the omegas is no longer one. And then instead of specifying, so to fully specify things, of course, we need to specify the total energy density. So instead of specifying rho zero, the sum of all the rho j zeros, you specify the Hubble constant h zero. Is 8 pi g over 3 rho 0 to the 1 half. And you specify it in the following weird units. You specify little h, where, let me write it down. Km. So we specify the Hubble constant today, and we specify it in these weird units, kilometers per second per megaparsec. Notices that the distances cancel here, so that you end up with the quantity of inverse time. And there's a factor 100 here that defines little h. So that's the meaning of the little h in the top part. Let me, is that visible? Okay. It might help to explain the historical reason for these weird units. So originally, the Hubble parameter was defined as the conversion between the distance to a faraway galaxy and its recessional velocity. So you would measure the distance to a galaxy in megaparsecs and multiply by this number to get its recessional velocity in kilometers per second. So according to that sort of astronomer's way of thinking about things, these are the natural units. The little h really dates back to a long period in the history of cosmology where there was just a big fundamental uncertainty, a huge measurement error on the Hubble parameter. So for example, you know, the modern value is 0.68. And Hubble's original measurement in these cosmologist units was 5. And there were periods in history, long periods, where different groups differed by a factor of 2 and would fight back and forth. So if you imagine, you know, being a cosmologist in that situation, you might say, you might want to distinguish between a situation where you've measured the size of something. So I've measured the size of some standard ruler and found it to be 10 megaparsecs, some fixed distance in, you know, proper distance. And a situation where I've measured the size of the standard ruler in units of the Hubble length, in as a multiple of this one fundamental number that I don't know. Then you might quote the distance as being something like 7 h inverse megaparsecs. So a system of units evolved. There was sort of a long period of history where everyone would quote the results of their measurements, keeping track of the power of h, which went into the measurement. So that, you know, if in the future the value shifted by a factor of 2, you'd know how to correct everything. So you can see how it sort of makes sense to evolve this system of units. And we still use it. You'll still, you know, nowadays people write papers where they'll quote distances in either h inverse megaparsecs or megaparsecs, you know, depending on what power of h enters the quantity. Now I would actually say nowadays it's a little unnecessary. The Hubble constant is measured to about 1%, same uncertainty as the other parameters. And so it doesn't really make sense to keep doing this. It's kind of a historical artifact, a weird historical artifact. But we still do it, and you'll get used to it. I knew I had sort of turned to the dark side as a theoretical physicist when measuring a distance in units of h inverse megaparsecs seemed like, instead of say meters, seemed like a reasonable thing to do. Okay. Now, you might notice the following. Based on our discussion of, you know, Friedman's equation of the physics, you need 4 parameters to specify the expansion history. And if you look at our standard cosmological model, there are only 3. So where did the 4th one go? And the answer is just by convention, everyone says that the standard cosmological model has 6 parameters. And by convention, the radiation density isn't counted as a parameter. But it's really there. So let me talk about that a little bit and sort of explain why sometimes it's not counted as a parameter. So the CMB temperature is very well measured. In fact, it was so well measured in 1999 by a satellite space-based instrument called FIRAS that no one has ever, since 1999, built an instrument that measured it better than this. Now, if you know the temperature of the CMB today, you can compute the energy density. You can use the blackbody spectrum to compute the energy density of all the photons in the CMB. And so this measurement is equivalent to this number, where I've the statistical error here is only 0.1%, so I've left it off the remaining, omitted it for the from the remaining formulas. This value of omega photon, h squared, this is the power of h that you end up getting when you do the calculation. So the equation that I've used here is the photon energy density for a black body is pi squared over 15 times tcmb to the fourth. Now, I want to check to make sure that I'm on familiar ground. Like this formula and formulas related to it or something that you covered in the first course? Is that, yeah, great. Assuming so, but I want to check. OK, now radiation also includes neutrinos. So if we add neutrinos, and I've made a little approximation here by assuming that the neutrinos are massless, which we know from the oscillation experiments is not exactly true. But in the massless approximation, omega neutrino h squared is 1.68 times 10 to the minus 5, where I've pinned that down from the CMB temperature measurement by using the fact that rho neutrino is 7 pi to the fourth over 40 times t neutrino to the fourth. Relative to the photon case, there's a factor of 7/8 because the neutrino is a fermion, and also a factor of 3 because there are 3 species. I've also used the fact that the neutrino temperature is 4/11 to the 1/3 times TCMB. I'm still on familiar ground, right? These are things that you talked about. Great. Okay, so adding these together, the FIRAS measurement of the CMB temperature is telling us that omega radiation, I omitted the zero before, but let me put it back. Omega radiation, that was a lie, no zero. It's 4.15 times 10 to the minus 5. So that's really just sort of assumed when we write this these parameters. It's really there, but we don't say it explicitly. Let me just bring that down and put it up. So omega radiation, let's write omega radiation h squared. It's 4.15 times 10 to the minus 5 with a very small uncertainty. Now, that's not counted as a parameter of the model, just as a convention. There's motivation from the convention. So if you're thinking about this model from a data analysis perspective and imagining that these are parameters that you have to pin down with experiments, then this one is just so well measured that you can kind of forget about it from the outset. It's uncertainty. There's a tiny statistical uncertainty here, but it's so small that it doesn't significantly feed into the measurement uncertainties of the other parameters. From sort of a fundamental physics perspective, there's another reason for not including it, which is that we don't really think of the value of a clock as being a constant of nature. If I had quoted this equivalently, if I had decided to make the seventh parameter be the CMB temperature, then that's a clock. That's something that redshifts and goes down with time. And so the time when we, it doesn't have any fundamental significance. It's just the time when we happen to be around making the observations. So that's the reason. Personally, I kind of think it would make a little more sense to include it as a parameter, but it's just a convention. Okay, just a couple more comments before I conclude the FRW review, so the time coordinates t, tau, and a are all useful in different situations, but the time coordinate that really that we really get to directly observe is the redshift, which is the same thing as the scale factor, just defined, I guess, the redshift z. And the motivation for that terminology is that in an expanding universe, these statements, by the way, are things that you all know, but I'm saying them anyway, and I even sort of implicitly use them a few times in the discussion. So in an expanding universe, photons redshift. As frequency proportional to a to the minus 1 or 1 plus z. And that's a special case. If you want to know, analyze an FRW geodesic, this follows from the geodesic equation for an FRW for a light-like particle. If you ever want to analyze what happens to a geodesic which is not light-like, but maybe has a speed which is some order one multiple of the speed of light, but not one. For general FRW geodesic, it's a special case of this fact, which is worth remembering. The general statement is that the physical momentum always goes down as 1 over a. So for a particle that starts out relativistic, redshifts down and becomes non-relativistic, then the momentum would go as, at high redshifts, the momentum is the same, or at relativistic velocities, the momentum is the same thing as the energy, so the frequency is redshifting as 1 over a. And then when the particle becomes non-relativistic, the momentum is just the velocity divided by m, so the velocity is going down as 1 over a. The kinetic energy would go as 1 over a squared. For a non-relativistic particle, the kinetic energy is b squared. The total contribution to the energy density would be constant because it's coming mainly from the rest mass, not the kinetic energy. Okay. So that's the end of what I wanted to say in review of the FRW metric. This was all sort of review, but I think the review was sort of useful because everybody thinks about things a little differently. So my way of presenting things is probably a little different from what you had the first time. All right, so I want to continue unpacking the meaning of these statements that define the standard cosmological model. So I reviewed the FRW background, and now I'm going to talk about the initial conditions, the initial perturbations. So the universe, of course, is a perturbed FRW metric. The FRW form of the metric is an approximation that works on large scales. When we say that the initial perturbations are adiabatic scalar, that's part of the model. Here's what that means. This means something very specific about the initial conditions, and I'm actually only going to give a partial definition for now, just to give the idea. I'll come back and flesh it out later. So at early times, and in some choice of coordinates. The metric has the form So the scale factor here is still a function of t only. T, but not x. And this new quantity zeta of x is a function of x, but not t. This function zeta is called the adiabatic curvature. So this is a very specific form of the metric. It means that there are no time-space cross terms, even to lowest order in the perturbations. It means that G, I, I on the diagonal, you have the same zeta everywhere. And there are no off-diagonal G, I, J's even in the presence of the perturbation. The initial condition is actually a little bit more than this. There's an accompanying set of formulas plus a set of formulas for the leading behavior. As tau goes to zero, as you approach the Big Bang, in all other fields, in terms of zeta. So I will write all of these formulas out later, but for now, let me just give a few to give the idea. So for example, the matter density. The matter density rho matter in an unperturbed FRW universe, it would go like this. And with the perturbation, the general statement is that the subleading perturbation shows up at order tau squared, where tau is the conformal time. It's a little bit easier to write these formulas in conformal time than proper time. Plus additional terms of order tau cubed. Just for fun, let me say, the radiation, just to write one more. Is the same thing, but with an a to the minus 4 here, of course. And the coefficient here turns out to be 4/9. So let me write to be elaborated and explained later, just the partial definition for now. It's just way easier to really explain in the context of a general discussion on gauge invariance than I'm going to do a bit later. So for now, I just want to kind of unpack the meaning of these initial conditions, leaving the details of the adiabatic mode as a subtopic to be unpacked later. But I want to make just sort of a comment on intuitively what the adiabatic mode means. This coefficient 4/9 is 4/3 times this coefficient of 1/3. In other words, if I see a 1% perturbation in the matter fluctuation, that's always accompanied by, if I see, a 3% fluctuation in the matter density, that's always accompanied by a 4% fluctuation in the radiation density. And that's related to the fact that the exponents here are -3 and -4. If I were to wait until the universe expands by 1%, then the matter density would go down by 3%, and the radiation density would go down by 4%, same proportion. So intuitively, what the adiabatic mode means is the following. The universe is perturbed, but a local observer that just lives on a world line and only sees a small local piece of the perturbation doesn't know that a perturbation exists. So they see, in other words, an observer living here where the matter density is 3% high and the radiation density is also 3% high, and an observer living here, where they're 3% low and 4% low, think that they see the same universe, just with a different time coordinate. One is just delayed relative to the other. In other words, there's no physical difference between, you know, very small parts of space-time, just a difference in how a local observer's clock is related to a global time coordinate. That's sort of the physical meaning of this mode. In a sense, it's kind of the minimal perturbation you could consider. It's one that isn't apparent locally, but shows up globally when, you know, particles start to interact with each other and move around. Okay. Another important comment is that there's a theorem that single field inflation always generates this mode. Always generates the adiabatic mode. This is a theorem due to Weinberg. We'll prove it later. So another way of thinking about this mode is that it's just the initial conditions that single field inflation gives you. Okay. The next statement I want to explain is what the power law spectrum means. So this is easy. So the definition of the power spectrum is simply the following. If I take the two-point correlation function of zeta in Fourier space, so the expectation value here is an average over restarts of the universe, or, you know, if you want rerunning inflation, this two-point function, which depends on two 3D wave numbers, always has a delta function on the right-hand side. It's only non-zero if the two wave numbers are the same. And the coefficient appearing in front, which now only depends on one wave number, is defined to be the power spectrum. Why is there a delta function on the right-hand side? Why must there be a delta function on the right-hand side? Rotation symmetry. That is close, but not quite right. The translation symmetry is actually the rotation symmetry is actually hidden here because I assumed that the power spectrum was a function of the magnitude of k, but not its vector direction. The symmetry that forces the delta function here is actually translation symmetry. One way to see it is that if an observer, if I just shift a realization of zeta, displace it by some displacement delta x, then this Fourier wave number will shift by e to the I k. If I translate everything by delta x, then zeta of k shifts by e to the I k dot delta x times zeta of k. So this guy shifts by e to the ik dot delta x. This guy shifts by e to the minus ik dot delta x. Ik prime dot delta x. And the only way that the result, so this is just an overall multiplier of e to the ik minus k prime dot delta x. And the only way that that overall multiplier can leave the answer unchanged is if there's this delta function on the right-hand side that forces k minus k prime to be zero. Just out of curiosity, what delta function would I have on the right-hand side if I wrote the equation without the star? I just put a star here by convention, but I could have written it with them. Yeah. I saw someone make a little plus sign. Another way of thinking about this is that if zeta is a real field, then if zeta of x star is equal to zeta x in real space, in Fourier space, that equation reads zeta of k star is zeta of minus k. Okay. So that's the definition of the power spectrum, and this component of the standard model just means that this function of k is a power law in k. That's the functional form. Finally, let me explain the meaning of Gaussian random. I'll define it in a little more detail later, but for now, let's just take the following to be the definition. So zeta is a Gaussian field. If each Fourier mode zeta k is an independent Gaussian random number, with variance, with k-dependent variance, determined by, given by P of k. Okay, so let me remind you that a real random variable x is Gaussian if its probability distribution P of x is given by this functional form. Sigma squared, where, so this is just where sigma squared is called the variance, and it's also the expectation value of x squared with, taken with respect to this distribution. A complex random number variable, complex random variable, just to get the factor of 2 right. So zeta of k is a complex number, even though zeta of x is a real field. A complex random variable is Gaussian. Let's call it z. If the real and complex parts are independent Gaussians, independent real Gaussians, with variance equal to 1/2 the expectation value of z star z. What I want to say about all this is that, aside from the fact that I didn't write out all the formulas for the initial perturbations, what's written here is a complete prescription for how you would, if you wanted to simulate a realization of the initial conditions on the computer, you could do it. This first board says that the entire initial conditions are determined by one scalar function of x, one 3D function. This part, the part about the Gaussian field, tells you how to simulate every Fourier mode. It says that if you want to simulate the initial conditions in some volume, what you could do is first on the computer, let's pretend that this volume is surrounded by some periodic box, so we could do periodic Fourier transforms. Then just loop over every Fourier mode k in the box. And for each mode k, the real and complex parts of zeta k are supposed to be independent Gaussians that you can draw from this distribution if you know the variance. And the variance is just given by this formula. You evaluate the power law spectrum at the wave number of interest. You go loop over every k and simulate the Fourier mode zeta of k. Take the Fourier transform to get back to zeta of x. Then apply these formulas to set the initial perturbations in all the fields, the densities of particle of various species, and so on. And then you're all set up to evolve the universe forward. So this is a complete specification once you have a complete prescription for how to randomly simulate a universe. Okay, so that's almost all the parameters in the model. Let me just make a few comments about the parameter tau. So tau, or the optical depth to the CMB surface, is related to the redshift when reionization happened. So if reionization happened at one redshift, you'll get one value of tau. If reionization happened a little earlier, and you have a screen of electrons going out a little farther, you'll get a slightly larger tau. For example, this Planck value of tau, this number 0.66, suggests that reionization happened, the first stars turned on and ionized all the neutral hydrogen in the universe at a redshift of around 8.8. And that updates an earlier value from the WMAP experiment, which found a different tau and a redshift of reionization of around 10.2. Now you might ask, who cares about tau? Is anyone really all that interested in whether reionization happened at redshift 9 or redshift 10? For that matter, you might wonder why it's even considered a parameter in the standard model. It's not from the perspective of fundamental physics, a fundamental constant of nature. In principle, tau is determined by the other cosmological parameters. Since the other cosmological parameters define a complete prescription for the expansion history and setting the random initial conditions, nature figures out how to form stars, how those stars release ultraviolet photons, and when the universe reionizes. And we don't actually understand star formation well enough to compute tau from the other parameters, but in principle, it's derived. It is an important nuisance parameter for the CMB. If you want to interpret the power spectrum that you see in the CMB and link it to the other cosmological parameters, you need to know the optical depth of the last scattering surface. But if you're not doing a CMB experiment, if you're analyzing some other type of data, like gravitational lensing data, say, then tau just would not enter the analysis at all. Furthermore, these other experiments, like gravitational lensing, have their own astrophysical nuisance parameters that are not counted as parameters of the standard model. So it's perhaps a little arbitrary that this one parameter is considered to be one of the six parameters, this sort of astrophysical nuisance parameter that's specific to CMB experiments. The reason that it is so important is that it just turns out that in practice, it's just sort of a nagging nuisance parameter that's degenerate with a lot of other things. For example, it is likely, at this point, it's unclear, but it seems sort of likely that our efforts to measure the neutrino mass in the future will be limited by our ability to measure the CMB optical depth. What you might find, we might end up in a situation where we do some experiment, like a small-scale lensing experiment, and end up with a very well-constrained combination of neutrino mass and tau. And if we had a better measurement of tau, then we could break the degeneracy and measure the neutrino mass really well. So tau, in practice, limits a lot of things. And like when tau shifted a little bit from WMAP to Planck, the other parameters move around as well. So just because it's so important in practice, it's counted as one of the parameters of the standard model, but that counting is a little arbitrary. Okay. So So that's the standard cosmological model. Those are sort of the ingredients for the physics we're going to talk about. So what I want to talk about next, so for the rest of the class, I'm going to, you know, just talk about, well, a bunch of different topics. I'm going to talk a little bit about the early universe and how the initial conditions of the standard model get generated. You guys have already had some discussion of that. I'm going to talk about the formation of the CMB, how you know, the CMB acoustic peaks get formed, for example, and how they link back to these parameters. I'll talk about the late universe, how structure evolves in the late universe, and what we can measure there. But the first topic that I want to talk about, because this kind of comes up everywhere. So there's a bunch of common ingredients that I want to get out of the way first. This is we talk about random fields all the time in cosmology. So I just want to talk a little bit about the math of random fields. So I'm going to talk in a little more detail about the things that I was saying here. So first, let's talk about Gaussian random numbers in one variable, real Gaussians. So by definition, a random variable X is Gaussian if its probability density has this form. The 1 over square root 2 pi sigma squared is there to make the integral come out to 1. Just to give some expectation values, so the expectation value of x squared is sigma squared. So as the notation suggests, the parameter sigma squared here is the variance of the distribution. Any odd power expectation value is 0, of course, by the x to minus x symmetry. Put a few more up, the expectation value of x to the fourth, well, you can sort of see by dimensional analysis that it has to be an order one number times sigma to the fourth. That order one number turns out to be 3. The expectation value of x to the sixth is 15 sigma to the sixth, and so on. Where did the coefficients 3, 15, and so on come from? Well, a nice way of thinking about that for physicists is that they come from Wick's theorem. You've seen Wick's theorem undoubtedly in some sort of fancier context, like a QFT context, where Wick's theorem is a statement about path integrals in free quantum field theories, which are just very high-dimensional analogs of the Gaussian distribution. But you can also apply Wick's theorem to just an ordinary one-variable situation. And see that what Wick's theorem says is that if I want to compute an expectation value like x to the fourth, I just sum over all contractions. And here there are 3 contractions. I could, you know, connect this x here, this x here, and so on. So there's a combinatorial factor of 3. And then each contraction, here there are 2 contractions, and each one carries a factor of the variance sigma squared, so that's the sigma to the fourth. Likewise, if I had 6 x's, there are 5 ways to contract the first guy. And once that's been contracted, the next uncontracted guy can contract with 3. There are 3 choices for how to contract that. And then the last leg of the contraction is determined. So there are 5 times 3, or 15 contractions. So Wick's theorem is a nice way to remember how to compute, because it's familiar for physicists, how to compute expectation values involving Gaussians and ordinary statistics. One reason why this probability distribution is so ubiquitous is because of the central limit theorem in statistics. That's why, like, a lot of things in nature are Gaussian. Just for fun, can anyone give a rigorous statement of the central limit theorem? I don't think I could until I started like doing statistics a lot. But basically, the statement is, there's a little bit of a digression, but it comes up all over the place, so I think it's worth saying, is that if your random variable x is the sum of a large number of independent, so the basic statement of the theorem is that if your random variable x is the sum of a large number of independent, identically distributed random variables, and n is much larger than 1, then the probability distribution of the sum of all these guys is close to Gaussian. I won't state it more precisely than that, but that's the general idea. So when you start adding together a bunch of uncorrelated contributions, if I have something which is random because it's the sum of a bunch of independent things that I'm not keeping track of, you tend to get something Gaussian. For example, random walks, if I have a random walk, you know, even if the probability distribution on a single jump in the walk is some funny, complicated, non-Gaussian distribution, after a few iterations of the random walk, it'll quickly become Gaussian, and the level surfaces of the probability distribution will look like ellipses. Let's talk about, now here's an interesting piece of physics. Gaussians are ubiquitous in nature essentially because of the central limit theorem. The CMB is observed to be Gaussian very precisely. It's one of the best measured things in cosmology. The CMB is Gaussian to, you know, roughly 1 part in 10 to the 3. And you can see that in all sorts of different ways. You know, the simplest of which is just take every pixel on a CMB map and just histogram the temperatures. You'll reproduce the bell curve of the Gaussian distribution to 0.1%. So imagine that you had noticed this, but you didn't know anything about the physics of the early universe. You might hope to explain this by some sort of model in which the initial fluctuations are built up from a bunch of random uncorrelated steps, you know, maybe with a more complicated or arbitrary distribution. But according to our understanding of the early universe, if the perturbations are quantum mechanically generated, say inflation, that's not why the initial perturbations are Gaussian. The initial perturbations are Gaussian for a different reason, a quantum mechanical reason, which traces back to the fact that the ground state of a harmonic oscillator, the ground state wave function of a harmonic oscillator, also has the functional form e to the minus x squared. As far as I could tell, there's no connection between the two. There's no connection between the fact that, you know, the central limit theorem of statistics gives this functional form and the ground state of a harmonic oscillator is Gaussian. I always thought that was physically interesting. Let me write down the n-dimensional Gaussian and then we'll call it a day. So an n-dimensional Gaussian is a random variable xi with a discrete index that runs from 1 to n. And now the variance becomes, instead of the expectation value of x squared, the expectation value of 1x times another x is now a matrix with two indices called the covariance matrix. So that can be a diagonal matrix, say, if the components are independent Gaussians, or there can be off-diagonal correlations. Just to define things precisely, the probability distribution is P of xi. This is a probability distribution in n variables. Turns out to be 1 over square root of 2 pi times det c. But you probably don't need, here's the probability distribution. The sigma squared became the determinant of the covariance matrix, and the 1 over sigma squared inside the x became the inverse covariance matrix. But for computing stuff, you probably don't need the form of this, the explicit form of this distribution. you probably want to use as your basic calculational tool Wick's theorem. So just easiest to explain how to compute by example. Let's say I wanted to calculate a four-point correlation function. You guys can all see when I write this low on the blackboard, right? There's nothing in the way. So if I wanted to compute this expectation value with four indices, Wick's theorem gives three contractions, the first of which gives a Cij. Each contraction gives one power of the covariance matrix. And this second contraction gives CKL. And then there are two more contractions. There's Cik, Cjl, plus Cil, Cjk. So just for fun, let me ask this computational question. Let's assume that you have a way of drawing a random sample from a one-dimensional Gaussian. That's easy to do. There's routines on the computer that you call, and they spit out a random variable with the one-dimensional Gaussian PDF. How would you then draw an n-dimensional? If I give you an n by n matrix, imagine that I just give you the numerical values of a 100 by 100 matrix. How would you draw a 100-dimensional Gaussian from this probability distribution? Well, since we're at the end, I'll just let you think about it. We'll come back tomorrow. Any questions before we leave off? Okay, see you guys tomorrow.